Super Talk Mississippi Media Production.
Greetings. Welcome to True American Heroes for the Record. This is Jack Rutland Jr., and I am very honored today to have with me a gentleman by the name of Jerry Jones. He is a retired Navy commander. I wasn't sure if I didn't need to salute him when I first met him, but no, he has been gracious enough to come in and let us talk a little bit about his service to his country, his experience wearing the uniform of the United States of America. And when he and I talked on the telephone here a while back about some of his days wearing that uniform and the things that he did, it really sounds interesting. So I think we've got a great program. Mr. Jerry, welcome to True American Heroes for the Record.
Well, thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Well, I have been looking forward to this, and you and I talked on the phone a while back, and I got a little information, and I've tried to kind of prepare myself so that we could have a fairly educated conversation. But I think I have to preface the program and my comments and our conversation with this. A lot of this all came about because you loved flying.
Absolutely.
You kind of had. How did you decide that you wanted to fly more than anything else? There are probably a lot of jobs you could have gotten that made a whole lot better money and probably less, more of a family life than what you ended up with. But why did you decide you wanted to be a pilot?
Well, I was living in Natchez, Mississippi, and my roommate had a little Cub airplane, and he and I go flying in the little Cub airplane, and I came to love it.
Now, how old were you then?
Oh, I was about 20, probably 22 years old.
Now, you graduated from Ole Miss.
I did.
And you ended up living in Natchez after you graduated.
Right. Yeah, I majored in marketing and sales management, and my first job was with R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company.
Yeah.
And I didn't even smoke.
Well, now, going back even earlier than that, you're from Macomb. You were born in Macomb?
Right. No, I was born in Houston, Texas.
Okay. But you grew up in Macomb?
I grew up in Macomb. I tell everybody when my dad moved to Macomb, it stunted my growth because I was supposed to be a tall Texan.
That didn't happen living in Macomb.
No, it didn't. Well, about 5'7" was my highest height.
Okay. That's interesting. So from there, you decided to go to Ole Miss and graduated from Ole Miss with a degree in marketing and
sales management.
And then you went to Natchez, and then you got to fly. Was that your first time flying when you flew in that Cub with your buddy?
It was.
Okay. Did he let you do the controls?
He let me use the controls a little bit, and that was a lot of fun. What was fun was we took off in the Natchez Airport, and it had a pretty strong wind that day, and we got to the end of the runway, and we throttled the airplane back, and the wind was so strong, it blew us back across one runway.
Oh.
So we had to add power to land.
Oh, my goodness. So you were learning all the things you needed to know to survive flying. Okay, that's really neat. All right, let's get on into your life and the direction that you ended up taking. Now, you mentioned that you joined the Mississippi Air National Guard.
Yes, sir.
Was your intention to be a part of their flight program or just to be in the Guard?
Well, I did it to beat the draft.
Now, what year? Do you remember what year that might have been?
Well, it was I graduated in 1963.
Okay.
And
shortly after that.
Shortly after that, I got my draft notice. Rather than letting them draft me in the Army, I decided to join the Mississippi Air Guard unit.
Right.
Because I didn't want to be drafted into the Army.
Exactly. All right. Now, you're living in Natchez. You've enlisted in the Air National Guard, and you're working for R.J. Reynolds. You found out about a Navy flight school or a test of some type that was happening in New Orleans. Is that correct?
Well, we went to the Naval Air Station in New Orleans, and mm-hmm. they had the test to see if you could qualify to go to pilot training. And my roommate and I, we both went down, and we both qualified for flight training in Pensacola. And we both went to Pensacola together to flight training.
Now, that's interesting. All right, you didn't... it sounds like... Well, you were in the Mississippi Air National Guard, which was Air Force.
Right.
And then you found out about this Navy, I guess it was a pre-qualification written test that you could see if you were sharp enough to be a pilot, because it does take a lot of brains. And you did well enough. You said goodbye to R.J. Reynolds and Natchez, and you went to Pensacola.
That's right.
Wow. Okay. So now you're at Pensacola. What did your folks think about that? Did they think you lost your mind?
I don't know.
You were a grown man, so you were ready to go to flight school.
I was.
When you went down there, did you have any idea? Did they tell you anything about what you might be flying?
No. They just go down. You go through primary flight training.
That's right.
And based on your grades and your... You're also going to school while you're there based on your schooling and how you fly the airplane. They give you, they send you to, everybody went to Whiting Field, and mm-hmm. we all mm-hmm. flew the T-28 there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then based on what you did there, you either get helos or jets, and I qualified for jets, but my wife and I had been married. We got married in 1966.
Wow.
And I said, if I ever want to see her, I better not go jets, because I'd be in Vietnam, and they were shooting a lot of airplanes down.
That's right. They sure did. They sure did. So now, I'm sure I've talked to people who've been to Pensacola and the Naval Air Station and the flight school there. It's tough, and it has to be, because this is the cream of the crop. These are the top guns. These are, well, not necessarily top gun, because that was a different type of school, but this is where every naval aviator pretty much got their start. At Pensacola.
Right.
And you started off in the T-34.
That's correct.
Which is a single-engine prop plane.
Right.
And then you went, interesting enough, to the T-28 that you just mentioned, which prepared you for carrier flight.
It did. We had to qualify after we got through flying the T-28.
I'm laughing to myself, but... having been around a lot of Air Force pilots, I laugh at them when they start talking about Navy pilots landing a plane on a ship, tossing around in the ocean and moving and dropping. I mean, it still amazes me when I watch jets being recovered on an aircraft carrier and launched. It's a breathtaking, and it looks to me like it would be a terrifying things, but you learned to do it right there at Pensacola in that T-28.
I was in the T-28. They had Bravo models and they had Charlie models. The Charlie models are the ones that had the tail hook.
Yeah.
And so we had to go train to go aboard the carrier. We went out to one of the outlying fields and practiced landing on an aircraft carrier. They had an aircraft deck painted out on the deck on the runway.
Okay.
And we practiced hitting that box. And then...
Jimmy, I'm gonna put you on the spot here, Mr. Jerry. That was a long time ago. But do you remember what you were thinking the first time you had to do that, to land that thing on that... Even though it was just painted on the field, you were under a lot of pressure. Was that a major stress to do that? Because everybody was watching, and you wanted to do it right.
Yeah.
And if you didn't do it right on an aircraft carrier, you might be all over with. But do you remember what it was like?
it was exciting to me. Mm. And I just, you know, I just kicked in my training that I had, and I did real well on it in my training, mm. you know, hitting the box. And then if you scored good enough there, then you were able to go to the carrier.
Did you do that? Did you land on the carrier?
Oh, yes, sir.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, the T-28 Charlie had a tail hook on it. So we, like I say, we practiced on a runway that had a carrier deck, you know,
right.
painted on it. And then when we got qualified there, then we went out to the ship and it was the USS Lexington.
Oh, yeah.
Which was a small deck.
Right.
But we went out in the, now the American Ocean.
Yeah, the American Gulf. All right. That's awesome stuff. We'll be taking a short break, and then we'll be back to hear some more of these wonderful stories. This is Jack Rutland, Jr., and today you're listening to True American Heroes for the Record. I've often thought, you know, and jokingly, because I have so much respect for those guys, but, you know, landing on an aircraft carrier is right up there with jumping out of an airplane if you're a paratrooper. That just doesn't make sense, you know. but this is so neat. So you qualified for carrier training. I mean, you got all that thing that you needed to do. But now all of a sudden they decide to put you into a different type of aircraft. You finished flight school?
Well, I went to carrier training over it, and we went to the USS Lexington,
mm-hmm.
and we had to get 6 traps. They call it a trap when you come in, you land, and your tail hook grabs one of the cables.
Right.
And then they told us that, you know, when you first time you do it, because as soon as you hit the deck, you go full throttle in case you miss it.
That's right.
In case you miss the cable.
Makes no sense. You think you want to slow down because the ocean's right out there.
Yeah, they tell you.
Oh, yeah.
They say you're going to go to full throttle. And you're going to keep it there. But they won't, once you catch that cable, you see the enlisted man. He came out and gave me a signal to pull my throttle back because I had it wide open. And because I caught the cable, so I pulled my throttle back. And then you just taxed it over and took off again, and we had to circle around. We had to get 6 traps to qualify. They call a carrier deck landing a trap.
Right.
And so I had to get 6 of those, and I got all 6 of them. And then we went back to Pensacola.
How did you end up then not going to carrier duty, but ended up going to, I think, the P3 at that time?
Well, I had to go to Corpus Christi, Texas.
Oh, that's right.
And go through multi-engine training. And we also had to get 6 traps in a multi-engine airplane. So
wow.
We practiced again, you know, for the multi-engine plane. And they had tail hooks, so we dropped our tail hook and we get 6 landings. I remember my instructor, he was sweating like a pig trying to show me how to do it. You know, and he bolted. They call it a bolter if you don't catch a cable.
Right.
And he got a bolter, and he was sweating real bad. And I said, I think I got it. Let me try. So he got me in the seat, let me try. And I got 6 straight traps.
Wow. Wow.
So
you were proficient. I mean, it was just almost like a natural thing, as I've heard a lot of times.
Yeah.
It's just some guys just can do it without, I mean, it's still stressful, but they're capable of doing that.
That's correct.
Okay, so after flight school and everything, you're assigned to an aircraft that has a totally different mission.
Right.
And tell us a little bit about that aircraft and the mission.
Well, after I got through qualifying at Corpus Christi, we got our wings. We were commissioned ensigns in the United States Navy.
Gold wings. Yeah.
I was USNR Reserve. And then, I had a chance to go jets, but I was married.
Yeah.
And I said, if I want to see my wife,
right.
I wouldn't see her because I would be over in Vietnam in
real
jets.
Quick.
And so I went P3 because I didn't think I'd get shot down over there.
So the P3, and I've been reading about a lot about it the last several days. It's quite an incredible aircraft.
Yes.
And a lot of people may not know what a P3 is, but I remember when you were talking to me, I couldn't pull it up in my memory as to what it looked like, but as soon as I saw a picture of it, I remembered how that aircraft is such a unique looking. And then as I read capabilities, I was amazed at what it could do. So you were flying a pretty high-tech aircraft.
Yes, sir.
The P-3, and you ended up being stationed where?
Well, I was in Moffettville, California. That's where I went to VP-9 in Moffettville, California.
And that was your squadron?
Yes, sir. VP-9.
Right.
And we just flew missions out of Moffettville off the coast of California. And then we were deployed. My first deployment was ADAC, Alaska.
Well, let me ask you this. You were talking about your missions off the coast of Alaska. What was the mission that you, what were you doing? What was the purpose of that flight and your crew? And you had a fairly large crew. You had about, what, 6, 7, 8 men?
I think it was about 13.
13 men. And it was packed full of electronic equipment.
It was.
A lot of it was classified, top secret stuff. But what was your mission all about? Why were you flying out over the ocean?
Well, we were looking for Russian submarines.
Ah. So and what year would this have been?
That was in 68, I guess.
Okay, and that was right as the Cold War was heating up.
Yeah. So we were looking for Russian submarines out there, and we would drop buoys in the water. You know, if we thought we saw a submarine out there off of ADAC, Alaska, we'd go out and drop buoys in the water, and that buoy would go down, and it would pick up. It was a microphone that it would pick up the sound of a Russian submarine. And it could go back
to
some of the equipment in the airplane, and they would send that back to the higher ups there, and they could tell what submarine it was.
Analyze it.
Yeah, they'd analyze it and tell what kind of submarine it was.
Okay, so you got sent to Alaska, and it was ADAC Naval Air Station.
Right.
Okay, and how long was that? Is a deployment the same thing as TDY?
Right.
Okay, so your temporary duty, you're still assigned to where you came from, but you're up there for how long? How long a period?
Well, basically 6 months.
Wow.
And you're just flying in and out of ADAC every day.
So was it cold in ADAC? Was it wintertime?
Oh, yes, sir. it got cold and it got hot up there, too. But when we got up there, it was snow knee-deep. It was cold. I didn't like it.
So you were there 6 months. How often were you flying?
Probably every other day.
Oh, my word.
Yeah, we did a lot of flying, which I liked because I love flying.
But how long would a mission last? How long were you out there looking for submarines?
Oh, it could last up to 8-10 hours.
Wow. And you didn't need to be refueled. You didn't.
No.
That aircraft couldn't be refueled.
No, it could not.
So you had that much fuel in that. That was one of the things that I read about that people said it was so perfect for the mission, this capability to stay in the air for a long time and reach up to 400 knots
yeah,
if it needed to but yet go slow enough where it could stay behind a submarine. Do you remember seeing or do you remember making contact with what was a Soviet submarine?
I did. We found one day we were out there, and we found six Soviet submarines on the deck. They were all in line with each other.
On the top of the water.
On the top of the water.
Yeah.
So we got some good pictures of them, and then sent those, when we landed, they were able to, send it to the people to analyze all that kind of stuff, and they knew what kind of submarines they were. And
that had to be a funny feeling to see. I guess, in reality, the enemy right there, and they know that you're looking at them, and you know they're looking at you.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my word. So was it a fairly common thing to find Soviet submarines?
Well, that's what we looked for, but it was not common to find. Like,
okay.
We found those six that day, but most time you don't find because they're submerged.
Well, that's incredible. Now, after your deployment to Alaska, you came back to the States.
Well, while we were in ADAC, we sent a detachment down to the Philippines.
Oh, my.
And we flew flights out of the Philippines. We sent three airplanes to the Philippines, and it was a base called Sangley Point. And we flew missions out of Sangley Point, out of the Philippines.
Did you end up going to the Philippines?
I did.
Wow. And it's the same mission. You were looking for submarines.
Right.
You know, the people, and I know I know the mission of a submarine, and I know the ocean is big, but when you think about a submarine and you think about the amount of square miles that our ocean has, I mean, you guys were really the only way, and I know there's such a thing as listening devices underwater and things like that, but your mission was so important for us to keep up with the submarine, because during the Cold War, the United States and Soviet Union and other countries, it was the submarine service that had such significant growth.
Yeah.
And you guys, man, you had a lot of responsibility to do your job and do it well.
Yeah.
So you were in the Philippines a few times and doing the same mission, came back to ADAC and then back to the States?
Right.
And then from there, was that when you went to Vietnam?
Yeah, we went to Vietnam.
Now,
well, actually, we went back to the Philippines.
Okay.
And out of the Philippines, we sent a detachment to Vietnam.
Mr. Jones, thank you. It's been an honor.
Oh,
I've enjoyed this. I've learned so much today because I didn't know a lot about your aircraft. But thank you for coming. And again, thank you for your service. Thank you for your wearing that uniform. And thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Greetings. This is Jack Rutland, Jr., and today you're listening to True American Heroes for the Record. And I am very honored today to have with me a gentleman by the name of Jerry Jones. Now, when you and I were talking earlier, your mission in Vietnam was totally different from what it was
right.
in Alaska or in the Philippines or even while you were in California off the coast. And I found it very interesting, even a little bit concerning, because you were flying missions. You tell us what you were doing in Vietnam.
Well, we kept an airplane. We call it on station. We flew around Vietnam. We fly over Saigon at altitude.
Oh, my word.
And then we let down on the other side of Vietnam, about 40 miles off the coast, and we were looking for infiltrators. That was a Chinese boat coming out of the north with weapons and everything. They would make a high-speed run to the beach, and the North Vietnamese people that were in the south,
uh-huh.
they would meet them and collect weapons and weapons and ammunition and rockets or what have you.
Good gracious.
And so we'd try to catch them, and they'd send a ship in there to try to locate them.
So how long were you in Vietnam? How long, or was it kind of like you said, you were over there only for a little while, but you were still out of the Philippines?
Right, yeah. We were over there for about 3 to 6 weeks.
Okay.
And I was lucky enough, I wanted to fly, so I asked, let me stay back as the on-duty co-pilot. So they let me stay back and let another guy that was supposed to be over, yep, let him stay back in, yep, the Philippines. So I got all the flight time that I could while I was over there.
If you were getting paid by the flight time, by the hours in the air, you would have been a wealthy man before long, because you were doing a lot of flying.
Yeah.
Now, that's an incredible mission. I know you told me one story about you were flying, and these were day and night. It didn't matter. I mean, they were in the air. And you told me about thinking that y'all were seeing something or something was down there, and you turned a huge floodlight on.
Yeah, and they turned their floodlight on. It was brighter than ours. So I went max power and got out of there.
So you cut yours off so they couldn't see where you were. Man, yeah, that would have been a little eerie feeling if you thought you were going to be able to see them, but ended up they had a bigger light than you did.
I didn't know if they were going to shoot or not.
So flying over land like that, did you have issues with surface-to-air missiles or things like that?
Never did. We were too high, really, for most of them. You know, when we went take off out of Cameron Bay, and we'd go to altitude and fly over Saigon and then let down on the other side, to the other side of Vietnam. Like I said, we kept an airplane on station 24 hours a day.
Goodness.
One airplane come off station and another one go on station. So we just, kept airplanes flying, looking for infiltrators.
How many of the Orions were there in Vietnam while you were talking about all these missions? How many was on the ground at the base? Half a dozen or a dozen? Or
we had three to four airplanes.
Is that it?
Yeah.
And they flew all the time?
Flew all the time.
You had to have good technicians and mechanics.
Yeah, just come back and get you some crew rest and be gone again.
So the flights would last up to 10 hours?
Yeah, could last to 10 hours.
Did you have a place where they could sleep or if they needed to?
We were in the barracks over there. We had barracks.
I meant on the aircraft.
Oh, yeah, we had some bunks on the airplane.
Wow.
But most of the time, nobody was in the
bunks.
Bunks because they had to be at their station.
So you didn't have to worry about SAMs or surface-to-air missiles, and you didn't really have to worry about enemy aircraft coming after you. Okay, well, that would have been nice. All right, so you're over in Vietnam, and you served in that capacity. Instead of your mission of flying over the ocean looking for submarines, you're looking for infiltrators and cargo being slipped into the enemy of the American troops on the ground there. So that was a pretty significant, important mission that you guys had.
Yes.
What rank were you then?
I was a lieutenant.
Yeah. But you were aircraft commander, too.
Well, later on, but you had to work your way up.
Was that determined by the number of hours?
No, it was just, in a way it was, but you had certain things you had to do to qualify to be an aircraft commander. And you usually didn't make aircraft commander until you were a senior lieutenant or lieutenant commander.
Okay, I got you. Navy rank is a little different from the Army and the Air Force.
Right.
All right, now, I'm trying to remember. You left Vietnam, and I'm supposed to tell me the story about St. Elmo's fire and what that is and what happened.
Well, when you're flying in clouds and It it's the static electricity that's it surrounds the windshield. It's all around the windshield of your airplane. And this particular night, a bunch of a ball of it came through the windshield, and it dropped down my pilot on the pilot quadrant, and it rolled through the airplane down the center of the airplane, all the way to the back of the airplane, went out the static wicks. The airplane had static wicks on all the tail back there. And it, so this St. Elmo's fire would, you know, go down and go out the static wicks. But it had people jumping because it was about the size of a basketball.
Oh, my.
Rolling down the hall there.
Jumping, I would have probably been hollering and jumping. So, I mean, did you know it was going to happen?
No, we didn't know it was going to happen. It just we just looked and saw it. But it came through the windshield and dropped down the pilot quadrant there, and then it rolled all the way.
Were you in the cockpit then?
I was.
So that was pretty close to you.
Oh, it was.
Did it make your hair stand up? It would have mine.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Just being scared out of my wits. My goodness. I've heard of that, but I've never heard of it happening in an aircraft.
Yeah.
And, oh, my goodness. So that's pretty incredible. Now, do you remember anything called Operation Market Time?
Oh, yeah.
Were you involved in that?
Yes, sir.
Now, I do believe my history is accurate. There was an Orion shot down during that particular operation. Does that ring a bell?
That doesn't ring a bell.
Something I read somewhere said that they lost one. May have been mechanical error or something other, but there was an Orion lost during Operation Market Time. And was that just a mission to do what you were doing, but more intense?
Yeah, it was just different places we'd do Market Time.
Oh, okay.
You know, just fly missions at different places, not just around Vietnam.
Oh, okay. You didn't fly anywhere you weren't supposed to fly, did you?
No, I don't think so. We used to fly off, in ADAC too, we used to fly off 40 miles off the Russian coast. And we've been intercepted by jets up there, so we didn't know what was going to happen. Hopefully, they were friendly.
Well, did the Russian jets interceptors ever show up?
Oh, they were there. We saw some there.
They were watching you.
They were watching us, and we were watching them.
And obviously, they knew what kind of aircraft and what your mission was and everything, but you know, international waters, it's supposed to be safe.
Right.
Okay. So now we're gonna talk a little bit about another phase of your career in the military, and it's really interesting because I don't know a lot of people who have had such interesting things. You go back to the States, and you're assigned. You become an instructor pilot.
Yeah, I went back to VT-2 as a flight instructor.
Now, were you doing check rides, or were you actually new students or new pilots?
Oh, I flew new pilots. You know, you go through phases of training.
That's right, different levels.
Flying formation is the last phase you fly. And so, yeah, I flew. Once the guys got through all the other training, they go to formation, and then we teach them, you know, how to fly a formation, you know, get close.
Correct.
Close to other airplanes.
Yeah.
I remember I had this one guy, he was a tackle for Michigan, I believe it was.
Oh.
Big guy, and he was scared to death. We got real close. I got real close to the airplane, and he was backing up in his cockpit up there. And I got even closer, boy, and he almost started crying. And so I broke off and took him home because he didn't make it.
But you got to find that out then. Yeah, that's right. Where you determine those things.
Right.
And it's not to make him less of a pilot,
right.
But it's just that aspect of a formation flying was not something he needed to be doing.
No.
Wow. Whew. Okay, so you're an instructor for those 2 years, and then they assign you something totally different. Where did you go then?
Well, my last tour there was, I went to VQ3 in Guam. Is that
okay? No, I didn't know about that. We didn't talk about that. What were you doing in Guam?
Flying C-130s.
Totally different aircraft.
Yeah, I had to go through, I think it was 6 weeks of training in Little Rock Air Force Base.
Yeah.
And we used to shoot approaches into the Jackson Airport just for practice, you know.
Mm.
And then flying the C-130. And then I went to VQ-3 in Guam.
How long were you stationed there? Was that a station or was that just a deployment?
No, it was a station.
Okay.
Stationed there for 2 years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, was your wife with you then?
She was.
That's good. That's good. That's good. So you flew C-130s out of Guam just carrying cargo around the...
No, it was called a C-130Q. It was another electronic...
Oh, my word. That's a lot of high-tech, top-secret stuff.
Well, we were a communications platform for the submarines in Westpac.
Okay.
We would go to an op area. They sent us out to an op area, maybe 40, 50 miles off the coast, and we'd just get in a racetrack pattern and transmit the instructions that we got from the command post. We would transmit their...
To the submarines.
Transmit their instructions.
Yeah.
And coded message track.
Certainly.
So that then they could decode it and they knew where they had to go to operate.
And that was just because they were so, wherever they were at sea, they were so far away from headquarters on Guam.
Right.
You needed to go out there and relay the information to the submarine.
That's correct.
Wow. Neat. People don't realize there's so much like that going on between different parts of the military, and they don't see what's all involved in getting a message from here to there. And in this case, it was putting you and your crew and the C-130 in the middle of the loop to get it to where it needed to go.
Right.
Wow. Well, that's just outstanding. So we're going to take a short break here, and then we're going to come right back, and we're going to get a little bit more of all of these wonderful things he's been talking to us about. This is Jack Rutland, Jr., and today you're listening to True American Heroes for the Record. So you're there 2 years, and then you came back to the States.
Right.
And your next mission, your next assignment was... Was that to Connie, the aircraft carrier?
No, I didn't. Well, I did go aboard the aircraft carrier, USS Constellation.
Okay, but you weren't assigned to it.
Yeah, I was assigned to the carrier.
Okay.
But I was an assistant CIC officer, as a combat information officer. And we worked down in about the second or third deck below the flight deck. And we just analyzed all the information that was coming to us.
So what was the Constellation was the carrier, and what was it like? How long were you on the Constellation?
It was a 2 year tour.
2 years?
2 years.
And so how long would a mission for them to be gone? How long were you gone from the land when you were on that continent?
Well, sometimes when I was on the Constellation, I didn't fly on the Constellation except medevacs and stuff like that.
Okay.
We had that was where I thought I...
You got to tell the story about transporting that guy back to the land where you were, the ship was not exactly where it needed to be.
Yeah, the this guy fell down and hit his body on a steel deck.
Ooh.
And he was in, you know, in bad shape.
Pretty serious.
So they told us get the airplane ready. So we had the airplane. We got it ready to go. The doctor and the patient came out to the airplane, got on the airplane, and the ship was turning into the, trying to turn into the wind.
And that's critical for taking off. That's what keeps you out of the water in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
It gives you lift under those wings to get off the deck because it's a short deck. Were you using a catapult on that aircraft then?
No.
It was just critical that you get good wind into the headwind.
So we were turning, though, and the air boss told us to roll that thing.
And so who's the air boss?
He's in charge of
the deck.
Ops on the carrier.
Wow.
And he told us to roll that thing. So we, the guy that was flying in the left seat, he added power, and we were not into the wind.
Oh, my.
And we came off the aircraft carrier, and we went down, and we almost went in the water.
Now, if you'd hit the water, it would have probably pulled you down.
Oh, absolutely.
And you were directly in the path of the carrier.
Absolutely. Yeah,
goodness.
If we had gone in the water, it would have run right over. But
I believe I'd have been chatting with that air boss when I got back and said, you like to got us killed.
Well, he did that.
Oh, my word. Okay, so you were on the Connie for a little while, and it's getting toward the end of your naval career. Is that correct?
Yeah.
So where did you, after you served on the Connie, was that when you retired?
No, I think they sent me.
a lot of different places.
I can't remember where they did send me.
That's okay. Your career ended up being 22 years wearing that uniform.
Yes, sir.
And when you retired, you were a commander.
Right.
That's pretty impressive career, and it's especially the different aircraft and the different missions and the service to our country. That's pretty doggone interesting. And did you stay in the reserves after that, or were you
no.
you said
that was enough?
Enough, guys. Thank you. And that's something that I always want to do in my program is when I'm interviewing someone who served, any of them, even those that just served 2 years or 3 years, thank you for your service. But when I get a chance to visit with someone like yourself who served that many years and did it in such a level of excellence that, you know, your promotions and your career was one very exemplary. And, you know, your country's grateful for that. And I know some may have never told you that, but you probably have heard it. But, you know, I'm so thankful that we had men like yourself that were willing to do what needed to be done, being gone from home, being overseas, being TDY, being deployed in Alaska. You know, not a fun thing, but it was a job and it was a responsibility you took very seriously. Now, I got to wrap this up. I mean, we're talking all about these great things that you were able to do and accomplish. You love flying, no doubt about it.
I do.
Okay. So when you retired from the Navy, you decided you wanted to do more flying.
Right.
Tell me about that real quick.
Well, I got on with Federal Express.
What year was that roughly? You remember?
Probably 1970.
Okay.
And when you get on with FedEx back then, you had to qualify as a flight engineer first. And so I had a flying partner. They assign you partners in there. And he and I was training for the engineer program. And he had been teaching the engineer program. I was lucky to get him because he had all the engineer charts and everything. and he had them over at his house, and we'd go over to his house and practice going through the checklist, you know.
Yeah.
Turning switches on. And
yeah.
Turning fuel on. And
all the things necessary.
All the necessary things to keep the airplane going. So it really helped me out.
So what kind of aircraft did you start off with FedEx?
727.
727.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Wow. And how long did you... Now, you eventually got into the pilot seat.
Right. But it was a while. You just kind of work your way up.
Well, it's kind of like other businesses now. It's a little different from the military. There was an attrition thing. They had to retire before there was a slot open in place. Now, they may have added an aircraft or something other, but most of the time, you had to wait for somebody to retire before you could move up.
Yeah, that wasn't the case with us. It was always available. And like I said, I started out as a flight engineer on the 727. And I don't remember how long I stayed there, but it was quite a while. and then I moved up to the right seat, which is a co-pilot.
Co-pilot, first officer.
I stayed there for quite a while, and then I was able to move up to the left seat, which is the captain position.
Wow.
That was fun.
Wow.
I really enjoyed
it. What were you flying when you finally got into the captain's seat?
727.
Same plane? Okay.
Same airplane.
Okay.
Yeah.
So were you living in Memphis?
Right.
Because back, I think in the early days, everybody that flew FedEx lived in Memphis or really close by.
Yes, sir.
That's an incredible story because I know I lived in Memphis for a while, and I thought I would never get used to the planes taking off at 2 a.m. or whatever time it was, 1 a.m. But you did get used to it and didn't even pay attention to it.
Right.
But that was – so how many years did you fly with FedEx?
13 years.
Wow.
But I only had to stop there because the Federal Aviation had a rule that you had to retire at 60.
Mm.
And so I retired when I turned 60, and about 2 years later, they changed the requirements, said you could fly to 65, but FedEx wouldn't let me come back.
Oh.
So I was done.
Your flying was over with.
It was over with.
Well, I'm going to ask you a question, and I'll be surprised if you can answer it, Mr. Jones. Any idea how many hours you have in the air?
I don't know. Somewhere between 10 and 12,000 hours.
Mm. Mm.
You know, total, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, flying as much as you were with that P-9 and then P-3, and then with FedEx.
Right.
I mean, that's an incredible number of hours. And you still love it?
Oh, yeah. If I wasn't in this wheelchair, I'd still like to be flying. Of course, it way past the 65.
Sure, sure.
I'm 84 now.
Oh, goodness. Well, let me say this. It's been an honor to talk to you, and we're going to wrap it up here briefly. And it's been an honor to have you be a part of True American Heroes for the Record. I want to thank you for the effort coming out to the radio station here for us to do this program and interview, and it's really cold outside, and yet you're here, and your son was so gracious to help you get here. Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Jones, for your service to your country. I think it's men like you that wore the uniform, that had such a conscientious desire to do what was right by your job and your country. That's what's made our military, as it has been, the greatest military in the world. And I want to thank you on behalf of your country for your service. And, you know, I don't know how you guys kept those white uniforms clean, but they sure were sharp looking, especially with those gold wings.
Yeah, that's
true. So I want to come back and share with some folks just a little bit. Mr. Jerry, do you remember when you found out about David Easley? Were you overseas then?
I can't remember. I think I was. But Rita was home.
Yeah.
My wife, she was home. That's her brother.
Right.
And I guess she passed the word to me.
To you. I'm going to take just a few minutes here, and it's really not a part of the interview, but it is a part of the interview because it's your family, because it's your wife and her family. I want to share with the folks who are listening that during your service all across the Pacific and the United States and the world, for that matter, you had a brother-in-law who was born in Brookhaven, Mississippi, who was a country boy, grew up for folks in Lincoln County, Mississippi, out on Highway 84 near the Brookhaven city limits, and had some brothers and sister, of course, and ended up enlisting in the Marine Corps. And I want to share a little bit about David. He was the son of Luther and Forty Easley. He enlisted in the United States Marine Corps on April the 3rd, 1969, in Jackson, Mississippi. And, of course, that was right in the middle of the serious battles that were going on in Vietnam. He arrived in Vietnam on September the 20th, was a part of the 3rd Battalion, 7th Marine, 1st Marine Division, and was a rifleman. That was his responsibility and a part of a group of Marines. And then while he was a part of a nighttime defensive position in the Pulock Valley and the company command post where he was that night, came under attack from a barrage of 82-millimeter mortar rounds fired by the enemy. And 10 to 20 rounds impacted within the Marine perimeter there at the where the Marine headquarters was for that group. And 14 men were wounded, 3 died. And David Easley was one of the fatal casualties. His name is on the wall there in Brookhaven, on the wall of honor for the men who died in World War I through Desert Storm in Afghanistan and Vietnam. And, you know, he was a part of your family. You were gone all the time when you're doing your duty and your responsibilities. But David has family still in Brookhaven and Lincoln County. And I say this to let people know that we don't need to forget not only our veterans like yourself, Mr. Jones, but we don't need to forget the men whose names are on the wall in front of the courthouse in Brookhaven, Mississippi, and on the wall in Washington, D.C. Vietnam was a somewhat controversial experience, but for the men who served and the women who served, they deserve our respect and our honor. And David Easley was a young man from Lincoln County, Mississippi, and we don't need to forget him and what he did and giving the ultimate sacrifice as just a young 19-year-old in Vietnam. And we just wanted to, while we were paying respect and honor to you for your service, I'm doing the same thing for David Easley for his service. Lance Corporal David Easley, United States Marine Corps. Mr. Jones, thank you. It's been an honor.
Oh,
I've enjoyed this. I've learned so much today because I didn't know a lot about your aircraft. But thank you for coming. And again, thank you for your service. Thank you for your wearing that uniform. And that concludes our program. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
A Super Talk Mississippi Media Production.